please stay tuned to the end of this program or see the show notes for important information regarding today's speakers and the content of this podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Allergy Talk, a roundup of the latest in the field of allergy and immunology by the American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. For today's episode, we will be reviewing three more articles from the November-December 2022 issue of Allergy Watch, a bi-monthly publication which provides research summaries to college members from the major journals in allergy and immunology. And you can also earn CME credit by listening to this podcast. For information about CME credit or to learn more about Allergy Watch, head over to college.acaai.org/publications/allergywatch. And make sure you check out the Doc Matter community where we discuss these articles. That's at docmatter.com. My name is Jerry Lee. I'm an associate professor at Emory University and an assistant editor of Allergy Watch. And today, once again, I'm joined by the editor-in-chief of Allergy Watch, Dr. Stan Feinman.
Hello, and thank you, Jerry. It's great to be here. Yes, I'm the current editor-in-chief of Allergy Watch. I'm also an adjunct faculty at Emory and in practice at Atlanta Allergy here in Atlanta.
And for the third chair, once again, we are joined by Dr. Shyam Joshi.
Yeah, thanks for having me again. I am the assistant professor of medicine and section chief of allergy and immunology up here in the Pacific Northwest at Oregon Health and Science University.
Okay, well, I think we got three more very interesting articles to talk about. So Stan, why don't you kick us off? A little bit reminder about the consequences of very common diseases we treat in children.
So this was an article that was published in the Annals of Allergy, and it's entitled Allergic Disease, Sleep Problems, and Psychological Distress in Children Recruited from the General Community. And it was reviewed by Vivian Hernandez-Triolo, one of our assistant editors. And I thought it was very interesting because we all know that allergic diseases in children are linked to sleep problems. And that, of course, can contribute to psychological distress. And the kids can also have psychological distress from just having a chronic illness. But this study examined the association between the allergic disease, different allergic diseases, sleep difficulties, and psychological distress. And it was a community-based sample study. So it was a questionnaire or a series of questionnaire that was sent out to the parents of 1,500 Australian children. This was from Australia. And they were answering the questions to get an association between whether or not they had allergic disease and how their sleep was affected by it. And the sleep problems were evaluated as a potential mediator of the relationship between allergic diseases and psychologic distress. So 46% of the children who were surveyed had one or more allergic disease, and 31% had allergic rhinitis. And on analysis, controlling for coexisting allergic diseases, a surprise to me was that the children with allergic rhinitis had increased problems with sleep routines, morning tiredness, nighttime arousals, and sleep-disordered breathing and also restless sleep, which are some of the problems in sleep that they were monitoring. Asthma was associated with sleep routine problems, some sleep-disordered breathing and restless sleep, and eczema was only associated with restless sleep. So on a path analysis, the sleep problems were a more significant mediator of psychological distress in children with allergic rhinitis and asthma, but not necessarily those with eczema. Now, granted, this is obviously a questionnaire that the parents are answering, but the bottom line is based on this questionnaire that analyzed, the allergic rhinitis seemed to be associated with a wide range of sleep problems in this non-referred. It was just a community sample of children, and it appears to be a key mediator of increased psychological distress among children with various allergic diseases, including asthma and atopic dermatitis. And what Vivian said was that this is just another study that helps to support the importance of our role as allergists in addressing the impact of sleep in overall health.
It's very interesting. I think what troubles me a little bit is that this is a survey, like you'd said, Stan, and how many of these patients are actually ever making it to an allergist? How many of them are actually getting to us that we can help improve their sleep by better management of some of these allergic comorbidities.
I mean, you're right, Simon. And unfortunately, that is a limitation in the study. This questionnaire was answered by the parents. And even though the children might have been diagnosed by a physician, they might have not been diagnosed by a specialist. So we don't know exactly the accuracy of their main diagnosis either. So that's a problem. But I think for me as a clinician, my take home is that I have started asking the children, the parents, more about how are the children sleeping? I mean, is their illness really impacting their sleep? And how stressful is it? So I'm trying to be more aware of the fact that this can impact sleep and consequently adding to psychological distress.
I think we know there's rampant issues in sleep hygiene in children. Obviously, the first thing we think about is technology, but screen time. But it's very simple. So interesting. A very common condition, like 1 in 10 in the population, can cause significant issues. And that has school impact and future potential. So again, I think, yes, I do like the key message that it's not just a runny nose. That is something to be taken seriously. And it's very treatable. It's very fixable. You know, most patients can get very good control of their symptoms. It's just recognition, the importance of it. And so it's a really good study to send that message and to convince generalists to be more proactive in just preventing some of these complications. This is a very significant percentage.
I would love to see a follow-up study that after they're treated, does the sleep dysfunction improve? And I think that would be very powerful.
Okay, well, we're going to go on the theme of helping children in need. And so asthma obviously is a very common thing that we deal with. And so, Shyam, I think you have something about how we could maybe help our uncontrolled asthma patients.
Yeah, this is a study out of CHEST in June 2022, out of a group from India, with the lead author or senior author being Dr. Kabra. And the study was titled Azithromycin for Poorly Controlled Asthma in Children, a Randomized Controlled Trial. And just again, a quick background, we do have a certain population of kiddos that do have uncontrolled asthma despite appropriate inhaler use. And while we do have biologics now that are available for a large percentage of these patients, they are expensive and there's limitations on how often we can give biologics. And so really looking at, is there other things that we can use to still improve asthma care? In adults, azithromycin has been shown to reduce the number of exacerbations, improve spirometry parameters. And even in the GINA guidelines, there is recommendation for adults that azithromycin should be part of our toolbox. But really in children, we have very little data. And so what this study looked at is they recruited children between the ages of 5 and 15 that had poorly controlled asthma based on their childhood asthma control test, or just a regular, if they're 12 and older, just an ACT score. And they were able to recruit 120 kids, 60 in each arm. One arm, they was a control group. They did not give a placebo or anything. So that's a limitation of the study. There was no placebo here. But in the other arm, they did give 10 milligrams per kilogram 3 times a week of azithromycin. They did make sure they checked everybody's QT intervals. There was no issues there for any of the patients. And they looked at their baseline ACT or childhood ACT score. And their primary outcome was, what does it look like after 3 months of regular therapy? One important thing in the two populations, the group that did end up getting the azithromycin did have a lower asthma control score, a 14.8 versus 15.8. So there's a little bit difference in the population. The group that got azithromycin was actually a little bit more poorly controlled. And they remained on their ICS or ICS-LABA per the GINA step-up guidelines. And then they looked at some secondary outcomes too. Based on the GINA guidelines, were they well-controlled? Were they not well-controlled? Number of exacerbations requiring oral steroids or hospitalization, spirometry measurements, FeNO, and adverse symptoms. So out of the 120, they only lost 5 to follow-up, which is pretty solid. And what they did show was an improvement in the ACT or childhood ACT score in the azithromycin group from 14.8 to 21.7, which is considered good control, versus the control group that didn't get anything. They went from 15.8 up to 18.3. So not as significant of an improvement. And even when they controlled for that difference in the population of the azithromycin group having a little bit poorer control in the first place, there was still a significant difference between the azithromycin and the control group. And there was no difference in the eosinophilic asthma kids versus the non-eosinophilic asthma kids. And I'll come back to that in a second. In addition, other results that they found, based on the GINA guidelines, 73% of the azithromycin group were now considered well controlled versus only 17% in the control group. They also did not see any difference in spirometry, pheno, or adverse symptoms. And only a few exacerbations were really recorded in this three-month period, so it's really hard to compare risk of exacerbation. So a longer study is really needed in this situation. And no differences in safety, that's very important. Limitations-wise, it wasn't blinded. It wasn't placebo-controlled. The population of children were from India, so how can we translate that to our population here in the U.S.? That's to be determined. And their exposures are different in India. The types of pathogens that they're exposed to, they may be more susceptible to macrolides versus ours, maybe less. So some limitations there for sure, and just how short the study was. But I do think there's some really important learning points here. So azithromycin could be underutilized in this age group and should be a tool in our toolbox to manage these children with uncontrolled asthma. And I think there's a specific population of kids, maybe those kids that don't have an eosinophilic phenotype. Those kids may benefit from this because we don't have as many tools to manage the non-eosinophilic type asthma kids. The other is, when we think of a lot of our children, they get exacerbations during the winter, like when it's cold season, when it's viral season, when it's infection season. And if they become uncontrolled despite appropriate therapy, it's pretty difficult to get seasonal biologic therapy, even though we know, like omalizumab has shown, that being on that during viral season doesn't just reduce the risk of exacerbations, but getting it seasonally is very difficult for approval reasons. But also, if we put them on year round, they may not need it for 6 months out of the year. And so this may be a good opportunity to use in children that really have specific times of the year that they have exacerbations and they can be on prophylactic azithromycin versus other times of the year they may not need it. We obviously need a similar study here in the U.S. with kind of our population, which would be a really interesting study to look at going forward.
I think it really is a good study. I'm glad you brought this up. I have not used this technique. The one thing that I thought was interesting, though, the ACT did show some benefit. I don't remember if you said it was statistically significant, but the GINA guidelines, it was dramatically better controlled in the group that used the azithromycin. Is that a better way to monitor the patients versus our ACT, which we use?
Yeah, I don't know. I think they included both because I think they felt like there's different ways to evaluate these kids. But yeah, there was a statistical significant improvement in both the ACT and childhood ACT, as well as the kind of GINA guidelines. So it showed it in both, but I agree that it was much more dramatic in the GINA guidelines.
I really like how you're really talking about individualizing therapy or the different options. I mean, certainly there's two considerations you've already told about. What is a less expensive option for patients with severe asthma who have a bears with access to biologics, but also the ones who don't qualify for non-T2. I recall the only time I've ever remember something like this was when I think Len Beccaria was involved in something called the APRIL study that looked at toddler wheezers, and toddler wheezers who did not have asthma predictive index criteria were potentially just as good as T2 high people to respond to azithromycin infection. So it sort of follows what you're saying. I think absolutely it's something that if we do shared decision making for parents who are not excited about doing injections or barriers, they have options. We have choices. And I think it's good to see evidence, but I do agree with you that further studies in our population would help seal the deal that maybe this is something that could be codified or at least would be more firm in the evidence to support it. So I got one more article about the pediatric population, and this is looking at early introduction. I think multiple times, either in this podcast or in other discussions, we've talked about the Australian experience with the implementation of the LEAP guidelines, that early introduction of peanut reduces peanut allergy based on the LEAP study. And the reason Australia has been just so successful is that they have these maternal health nurses that are assigned to young mothers, and they can help them with nutrition and implement public health educations. And so when they looked at the comparison between the original Health Nut study that was done like 07 to 2011, they implement the guidelines around 2016. And then the Early Nut study, remarkably, from 2017 to 2018, they had like almost 90% of infants in the early adult study who introduced peanut in the first year of life. That's remarkable adherence to the guidelines. And so Australia has been a great way to sort of look at, okay, if you are able to get the majority of your population to implement early introduction, how do we do with outcomes in the real world setting? This is sort of like a pair of articles. The first one I was going to talk about was in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology. The title is Changes in Australian Food Anaphylaxis Admission Rates Following the Introduction of the Updated Allergy Prevention Guidelines. The lead author was Dr. Mimi Tang. And you would imagine, yeah, we are introducing allergenic food to infants. What's going to happen to food anaphylaxis, either on the prevention side or the increase side, right? I mean, makes sense. And so, again, they have this hospital database. So they can pull Australian hospital admissions data. It's the Australian National Hospital Morbidity Database Principal Diagnosis Cube data. And they looked at different time points. They look back in 98, 99, and they kind of fast forward to 2018, 2019, and everything in between. So they have three major periods that they're really looking at what is happening to childhood anaphylaxis pre and post guideline implementation back in 2016. And the bottom line is that you shouldn't be surprised by this, but actually admissions for anaphylaxis in infants increased. And you could imagine that there are children who probably did have peanut allergy. We made this recommendation to introduce peanut allergy, and there was an increase in infant anaphylaxis. Now, what about after you get out of 1 to 4? And so this is what happened. 1 to 4 years of age, peanut allergy still increased, but versus previous years, it did seem to slow. So there was a slowing of the rate of increase from 1 to 4, and that also continued in the 5 to 9 to 10 to 14. And they attribute that to an earlier recommendation not to delay introduction. So again, even though early introduction was recommended in 2016, back in 2008, they said, as you remember, there was sort of like no recommendation, right? We're not saying you should delay it. And those above 15, before the 2008 change, there was an ongoing acceleration for food anaphylaxis. So taken together, if we look at 15 above, that's the consequences of the delayed introduction. That's an increase in food anaphylaxis. We clearly know that that's not helping our patients. But what remains to be seen based on this study was what's going to be the further impact on allergic reactions. There is a slowing, but it's still increasing. And so moving the needle based on this study did not seem to tell the whole story. Now, there's a companion article to this that was published in JAMA, and that one's called The Association Between Earlier Introduction of Peanut and Prevalence of Peanut Allergy in Infants in Australia. Jennifer Copland was the lead author. And this one looked at sort of a cross-sectional study looking at the diagnosis of peanut allergy. And unfortunately, they did not see a statistically significant lowering of peanut allergy prevalence, despite this sort of 90-plus success of introduction shown in the early nut study. So that was immensely surprising. And in the world setting, we're still just trying to grapple with what we're missing in terms of moving the needle on prevention. I think we have clear evidence that delaying introduction is not helping the situation, but the effect of early introduction doesn't seem to have the magnitude of protection we were at least hoping for. And so it shows that we are still looking at other factors. Is it potentially we need to make sure they're eating it longer, more consistently? Is it just basically early introduction slowing what's already happening, but it's still overall increasing? We need to do other things. I think the jury's still out. But again, I think these sort of two studies are kind of showing us the legacy of the LEAP study and shows there's some further needs that needs to be done.
I think in that JAMA article that you're referring to, they were looking at the entire population of kids and not just kids that were higher risk, if I recall correctly. And so when you look at all comers, I think that kind of makes sense in that several studies have shown that it's really that early introduction in that target population of the moderate to severe eczema, the egg allergy kids, those are the ones that actually you're going to get the difference. And when you're in Australia, I think did the right thing by just making this is a recommendation across the board for whoever, just to make it a little bit more easy to follow. But I'm not actually surprised that we didn't see a huge change, because when you're looking at everybody, I don't think it's going to make a decrease in peanut allergy in those other populations.
I just think the data is amazing. I mean, the fact that they are able to collect this much data and show us the impact of our interventions is helpful. But then again, as you said, there's so many variables that it's hard to, obviously, I think that we are continuing to encourage early introduction. But I was a little surprised that there was still so much anaphylaxis in the infants.
I know we're continuing to work on this problem. We're still banging the drum, and we're still absolutely recommending best practices for patients, especially as, Sean, I completely agree with you, we have to definitely target those at need, because there's clear evidence for that in the high-risk population. So if you really liked what you heard today, please rate our podcast on iTunes. And if you have feedback, corrections, or suggestions, email us at allergytalk1word@acaai.org. If you want to claim CME credit, the website is college.acaai.org/publications/allergywatch. This is Jerry Lee. I appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us. We welcome further discussions with you, and enjoy the rest of your day. The ACAAI is presenting this podcast for educational purposes only. It is not medical advice, nor is it intended to replace the judgment of a licensed physician. The college is not responsible for any claims related to the procedures, professionals, products, or methods discussed in the podcast, and it does not approve or endorse any products, professionals, services, or methods that may be referenced. Today's speakers have the following disclosures. Dr. Lee has nothing to disclose. Dr. Joshi has been an advisory board member for Takeda, Leo Pharma, Sanofi Regeneron, Nectar Algae, and Cogen, and has had clinical trial funding from GlaxoSmithKline and Sanofi. Dr. Feynman has been a speaker for Takeda and has done research for AI Immune, DBV, and BioCryst.